Nick Redfern, our special guest now on Coast to Coast. His latest work is called Shapeshifters, Morphing Monsters and Changing Cryptids. I'm looking forward to this next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Nick Redfern is the author of more than 40 books on UFOs, lake monsters, zombies, Hollywood scandals. And, of course, he's investigated the Roswell UFO conspiracy, women in black, men in black, and so many mores. And he is a regular guest on Coast to Coast. Welcome, Nick Redfern. Nick, always a pleasure.
Hey, George. Likewise. How's things?
Things are good. Our webmaster of the night, Greg Bishop, says hello. Says he just is one of your dear friends.
Yeah, I've known Greg many years, probably 20 years now, something like that.
That's great. Super, super, super. Brand new book out, Shapeshifters. What are shapeshifters, Nick?
Well, I think when you mention shapeshifters, people traditionally, you know, think of classic werewolf-type stories. But when I was putting the book together, one of the things that sort of really intrigued me was the fact that, you know, you can go far beyond just the issue of werewolves when you're talking about shapeshifters. For example, in the book, I've got stories of people claiming to have seen Bigfoot-type creatures sort of literally morphing into other creatures. Reports of men in black actually sort of changing their shape and form. And so, in other words, the book really doesn't just sort of focus on, as I said, the traditional werewolf folklore, which is certainly in the book, but it also demonstrates how so-called shapeshifters can be found in the UFO subject in relation to Native American belief systems, UFOs, crop circles, the chupacabra. And so, in other words, it basically goes far beyond the general image that people have of when you start talking about things like morphing monsters and changing cryptids. It covers all that, but it also goes much further as well.
It's really a book on the supernatural, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's the whole issue of shapeshifting is very controversial. And the more you look into it, the more you find we are dealing with something that is sort of definitively supernatural, but rather than, you know, extraterrestrial or traditional cryptozoology. And that's one of the sort of the challenging things. You're dealing with a subject which, you know, when you're dealing with the paranormal, the supernatural, even the occult, you find yourself really going down some very odd and sinister pathways, really, and particularly with regard to these sort of nightmarish shapeshifter creatures.
Was there ever a time, Nick, early on in your career that you would have said to yourself, ah, this stuff's not real, come on, Nick?
Well, I think, you know, that you always have to keep an open mind on various things like this. And, of course, the more controversial the subject is, the more rigorous you need to be in terms of investigating the stories. And that's what I did, you know, with this book. I mean, there are sort of multiple dozens of, you know, first-hand interviews with people. And I always think it's important to, when you're speaking to people, you know, you become a good judge of character. And when you speak to people and they, you know, you sit opposite them and you hear these stories and you can see the concern in their eyes, you know, and in their voice. And, you know, they just want answers as to what happened. For me, this demonstrates, you know, the credibility of the witnesses, even though the stories are, you know, incredible and highly controversial. So I always think, you know, that it's the witness testimony that is so important, and it's important, you know, to help to try and determine the validity of what they're saying, you know, and the best way to do that is sort of first-hand interviews, get corroboration, and also, as I also point out in the book, you know, actually get out to the sites where these encounters have occurred and look for the things on a first-hand basis.
You have talked about skinwalkers in the book. How did they enter the story?
Well, the skinwalker, you know, is a very intriguing but also sinister type character, which, you know, plays a major role in Native American lore, to the extent that a lot of people in the Native American world will not even mention the word. You know, as I talk about it in The Bird, you know, I refer to it in the book as the S word, because a lot of people that they literally will not talk about it. Now, the Skinwalker is, as I said, a very dangerous or potentially dangerous shapeshifter that, according to the ancient lore, can take on multiple different forms. But also, there are a lot of bizarre and sinister side effects as well. For example, when people have been in close proximity to skinwalkers, they've reportedly fallen sick and ill very quickly, almost as if they've been sort of paranormally infected or supernaturally infected in some way. And talking about sort of first-hand investigations, back in 2010, I did a TV shoot for VH1 where we actually went out into to the California desert where there'd been reports of skinwalker-type creatures. And I actually got to see firsthand the seriousness with which, you know, these reports are taken, and also the deep concerns that people had about, or reluctance, I should say, even, about talking with regard to these experiences. But one of the things that I was told was that the various sort of multiple forms that Native American lore suggests the skinwalker can turn into, many of the people talked about seeing these giant wolves, which were far bigger than any regular wolf that you would ever see, and that includes sort of, you know, prehistoric wolves as well. And again, you know, listening to these stories of people telling me how they saw these sort of massive wolves that reportedly could walk on four legs and also rise up onto their back legs as well, you know, not only did it create sort of a werewolf type imagery, but it demonstrated, you know, the sort of bizarre nature of these skinwalkers. And a couple of people told me stories of how they'd seen these wolf type creatures morph into the form of like an old lady, and sort of a sinister looking old lady. So although, you know, that the skeptics might write these stories off as just folklore, what fascinates me is that these ancient beliefs are still there, you know, and they're taken extremely seriously as well.
They sure are. And, you know, with these skinwalkers, have they ever been known to hurt anybody?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess it depends how you sort of define, you know, hurt people. I mean, I talk again in the book, and, you know, I just briefly mentioned earlier how people have talked about having fallen sick and ill in close proximity to skinwalkers. Now, in that particular situation, we're talking about people literally almost overnight, in some cases, going down with very bizarre and rare and serious illnesses that, you know, required, you know, emergency treatment. And I think I've probably got somewhere in the region of about 7 or 8 cases of people who allegedly were in very, very close proximity to these creatures, including these large wolf-like animals, and then they got sick. Now, whether that's just, you know, a byproduct of some sort of energy given off by the skinwalkers, or whether it's a deliberate attempt to target us, you know, I think the jury's still open on that. But to say that there have, you know, there have been people harmed by being in proximity to these creatures, that is correct.
Nick Redfern with us. His latest book is called Shapeshifters. You toss in Men in Black and shapeshifting. How do you correlate that?
Well, I think, you know, George, one of the interesting things is when you think about the Men in Black, most people outside of ufology would think of, you know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones.
That's right. Movies.
And even for a lot of people in ufology, you know, the assumption is that the Men in Black are government agents, so to speak. But when you look at the vast majority of all the reports, there are actually a lot of weird and supernatural aspects to the Men in Black cases. You know, they're typically described as being very pale and skinny and give off this sort of sinister vibe. The reports of Men in Black turning up on people's doorsteps late at night and having this sort of mind control ability to force people to open the front door and let them in. You know, so it actually takes us down some very odd pathways. Now, in terms of shapeshifters, one of the most bizarre stories that I got, this going back to a couple of years, came from a lady who had had a UFO encounter. This was in California. Mm-hmm. Had a UFO encounter, and 2 days later was visited by these two creepy men in black, you know, the classic imagery of the sort of pale skin.
No personality.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of almost zombified, like, and warned her not to talk about these particular encounters that she'd had. And she was sort of terrified, you know, just pinned to the couch with fear. And as they got up and left the room and went to the front door, opened the front door, went down the driveway, and the woman just basically sort of had the strength and power to stand up to slam the front door behind them. As she went to do that, she said she saw the men in black kind of shimmer, and they sort of shrunk into two balls of light, bright balls of light, which then winked out of existence. Now, reports like that are almost incredibly impossible to figure out and understand properly.
It's difficult to comprehend, too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But that's actually not the only case I've got along those lines. An equally bizarre one is a man and his wife who had their own encounter with a man in black, and who, in a very bizarre situation, they said morphed into like a large black dog with fiery, blazing red eyes.
Jeez.
Yeah, so, you know, it really takes us down almost like a, you know, real-life horror story, so to speak. And again, I spoke to these witnesses both personally, in person, not just on the phone or via email, and you know, they all came across as very, very credible, even though the stories are incredible. And for me, it demonstrates further that whatever the men in black are, it goes far beyond, you know, as I said, the Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones
sure.
of
well, you, it sounds like you don't believe they're government agents.
No, I don't believe the men in black are. Now, that's not to say that that occasionally, you know, governments may have possibly even sort of utilized or exploited the Men in Black phenomenon by actually dressing up in the black suits and you know, silencing people in certain UFO cases. But I think if that has happened, it's because the government has latched onto the pre-existing reports, which are far more supernaturally based. But these stories of the Men in Black kind of changing their form, they're certainly not, you know, talked about in the vast majority of the reports, but there are enough cases on record where they have changed their form, their shape into another kind of entity. Or with these balls of light, it kind of suggests that they may be some sort of intelligent energy almost. You know, the idea of literally being able to alter their form from human looking to these sort of like beach ball sized balls of light, which then wink out of existence.
Did anybody ever say that they branded weapons or anything like that?
No, that's the, you know, the odd thing. You would imagine that if they were from the government or, you know, from some rogue agency, that there would be a degree of, you know, flashing ID cards and warning people and, you know, but it's almost as if the threat actually is kind of delivered by things that just are not human. I would say of all the, you know, having done several books on the Men in Black, I would say close to 100% of the reports I have actually fall into this weirder, far more supernatural category, where, as I said, they look kind of zombified and pale. They look ill and sickly. And again, there's also a parallel with the skinwalkers, that there are a number of reports where after the men in black have left, they, in the days that follow, the witnesses, again like the skinwalkers, have fallen sick, again, as if some sort of supernatural residual energy of a very negative nature has been left behind in the home, and it's sort of impacted on the health of the person, which of course, you know, again takes it far, far away from the, you know, the angle of, oh, it's this agency or that agency.
Nick, you tie in black-eyed children in this. David Weatherling's work, it's pretty frightening, these strange kids that show up at your doorstep,
yeah,
and they want in.
Well, yeah, again, I mean, this is a very, well, the case that I talk about in the book, again, is a very weird one. Now, I get to actually get a lot of black-eyed children reports, and I think primarily because there are a lot of deep similarities between the tales of the black-eyed children and of the men in black, in the sense that, you know, the black-eyed children will turn up people's homes late at night and try and find a way into the home, which, you know, is very much like the sort of the angle that the men in black follow. And again, that, like the men in black, the black-eyed children look pale and sickly, and they dress in black hoodies. So there are a lot of sort of overlaps between these two phenomena. But the case I talk about in the book, again, is a, you know, an equally bizarre one, where a woman had this particular encounter late at night, classic scenario, you know, just sitting watching TV, and suddenly there's a knock on the door, you know, and very late at night, you think, well, who on earth's that? She went to the spot, looked through the spy hole at the front door, and saw these two children, you know, the typical thing, the black hoodies. They were looking down at their feet, clearly in a way to try and prevent them from, you know, for the girl from seeing their eyes. And so she put the chain on and opened the door. What do you want? We need to come in. Will you let us in? And that's one of the intriguing things, is that they always try and find a way to be invited in, which ties in with the old traditional stories of vampires, you know, the idea that these creatures have to be invited into the home. They cannot just sort of crush the threshold, so to speak. But she talked about how, as she stared at these black-eyed children, that she got this deep sense of evil coming from them. And she felt, with hindsight at least, it was almost as if she'd blown their cover. And she said that for a second or two, they sort of shimmered, almost like in a heat haze. And they went from looking like sort of, you know, 11 or 12-year-old kids to literally morphing into the sort of classic reptilian type creatures that people talk about, these sort of 7 or 8 foot tall reptilian type humanoids, and then shimmered back again into the form of these black eyed children. And not surprisingly, she slammed the door, and she actually told me she sort of just headed to the, you know, the furthest part of the house and just sort of hunkered down on her hands and, you know, on the floor, and just lay there, just sat there, just quivering, you know, not knowing what to do. But she was plunged into, you know, a complete state of fear by seeing the, not just the black-eyed children, but seeing them kind of morphing into these, all I can call them is like bipedal lizards, you know. And but it was interesting, the fact that there was this sort of shimmering, as if, with hindsight, again, she wondered if they'd actually shapeshifted, or if the shapeshifting was actually the entities themselves manipulating her mind into seeing them in different forms to kind of amp up the fear and the anxiety.
I want to get your take, Nick, when we come back, on just what you think all this is. Plus, we'll talk about the Bigfoot connection and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Nick Redfern with us. His latest book, Shapeshifters, Morphing Monsters and Changing Cryptids. How does Bigfoot fit into the equation here, Nick?
Well, yeah, this is an interesting and, again, like a controversial area, George. Most people, you know, when you think about Bigfoot, you think of the classic image of these sort of 7 to 8 foot tall ape-like animals, and predominantly being reported, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, you know, the massive forests.
Right.
A lot of people don't associate Bigfoot with Texas, but East Texas is heavily forested, and particularly more so as you get closer to the border with Louisiana. Now, not too far outside the city of Houston, and not at all far from where a lot of the storms and flooding happened just recently, is a large area of forest called the Big Thicket. And the Big Thicket has a road running through it called Bragg Road, but locally it's known as Ghost Light Road. And for decades, people have been reporting seeing these strange balls of light flitting through the woods, anywhere from about the size of a golf ball to like a basketball, that kind of size. And people have described them as having some sort of, almost like an intelligence, that when they've seen these balls of light flitting through the woods, they've, in a couple of cases, people have tentatively approached them, and the balls of light have either come towards them or backed away from them, but clearly reacting to the presence, almost as if they're an intelligent energy. Now, this sort of leads into the research of a late Bigfoot researcher named Rob Riggs. Rob died a couple of years ago, but he wrote a really good book in 2001 called In the Big Thicket, which is a study of the Bigfoot phenomenon. And like a lot of researchers, Rob got into the subject and felt initially that these things were just, you know, unidentified apes of some kind. The more he got into it, the more he found a lot of really weird and alternative aspects to these stories, one of them being that where people were seeing these strange balls of light, they were also seeing Bigfoot-type creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob tentatively came to the conclusion that it was some sort of residual energy given off by the Bigfoot. But in saying that, there are some people who claim to have seen these Bigfoot-type creatures in the Big Thicket area, and not so much suggesting that these balls of light were a residual energy somehow created by the Bigfoot, but the balls of light were the Bigfoot-type creatures morphed into these balls of light. In other words, it was one and the same thing. And I have probably somewhere in the region of about 14 or 15 cases where people have seen these sort of huge, lumbering, ape-like creatures in the Big Thicket suddenly alter their form into these balls of light. And again, they're so controversial, but what's particularly intriguing is that, you know, you speak to numerous people who don't know each other, have no axe to grind, no agenda, and yet they're all telling broadly the same story of how these things, at one second they were these large apes, the next second it was like this powerful, brilliantly lit form of energy, if you like.
Dogman. Tell me what Dogman is, first of all.
Well, the Dogman, George, is chiefly sort of the modern-day terminology for what centuries ago would have been known as a werewolf. Now, Linda Godfrey has done a tremendous amount of research into this area, demonstrating that a lot of reports of Dogmen come from Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and typically people talk about seeing these large wolf-like animals that have the ability to walk on four limbs and two limbs, which obviously, you know, on the two limbs gives them this sort of werewolf-type atmosphere, so to speak. And you can make a case that there are deep parallels between the Dogmen and the skinwalkers of Native American lore. You know, very similar, these sort of strange, oversized wolves. But what's particularly intriguing about the Dogmen is that they have this ability to sort of not just stand on, you know, go from four limbs to two limbs, but in some cases people have described the limbs of the animals morphing, almost as if, you know, that they're physically changing to allow them to go from 4 feet to 2 feet, rather than just standing up, you know, like a bear would, you know, in a conventional way. It's almost as if the animals are supernaturally changing their bodies so they have this ability to walk on two limbs. What's interesting about the Dogmen reports is the locations where they're seen. time and time again, they are like around some of the ancient mounds that you could find in places like Ohio and Wisconsin, built centuries ago. We get reports in the UK where they've been seen around stone circles, ancient burial grounds, things like this. And so whatever these creatures are, they're clearly not just normal or abnormal, unknown animals. There's some sort of supernatural aspect to them as well. Now, of course, I understand when you start talking about dogmen and parallels with werewolves, this gets into highly controversial areas. But, you know, when we talk about werewolves today, most people think of the, you know, the classic Hollywood imagery of somebody bursting out of their clothes on a full moon. It's not like that when you read the real reports. You know, certainly that's the way they look, but the shape-shifting revolves more around the limbs. It doesn't revolve, you know, around about a person literally morphing into, you know, an animal. So I find that kind of intriguing, and the fact that, as I said, there are certain locations which time and again crop up. And again, one of the other parallels that we had with the Native American skinwalkers and the men in black, and which we also get with the dogmen, is that when people get too close to them, they feel nauseous, they feel sick, and in some cases they literally fall sick. Again, suggesting there's some sort of negative energy at work, whether it's designed to keep us away or whether it's, you know, whether it's not even done deliberately, but there's something going on where people don't react in a good physical way to being in, you know, in close proximity to these things. That what happens is that the person, you know, literally does get ill. And I've got a number of cases in the book where this has happened, and the person has had to, you know, have a significant amount of treatment to cure what is sometimes like a really bizarre and extremely rare, you know, type of illness or disease. I've got several cases where people had seen dogmen, and they went down with like staphylococcus infections, and which had to be treated, you know, which got quite serious in one case. So when you put all those cases together, you know, it takes on a very sort of disturbing kind of vibe.
You've touched all the bases in this book, Shapeshifters. You even touch on black helicopters.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, most people probably think if you're going to talk about shapeshifters, you're going to be talking about living creatures, of course. And for the most part, that is what the book covers. But I thought it would be sort of cool to sort of look at, you know, another angle of shapeshifting. Now, most people, if not everybody listening to the show right now, I'm sure has heard of the black helicopter phenomenon, which very often turn up in UFO sightings and in relation to cattle mutilations particularly as well, you know, where a rancher hears this helicopter over his property late at night, looks out the window, sees this black helicopter with no markings. Next day, goes out into the field and one of his cows is laying there, you know, with organs removed, etc., etc. And that is sort of, you know, the kind of scenarios that we have these black helicopter sightings in. But what's particularly weird is that in some cases these helicopters don't appear to be what we would call normal helicopters. Now, there are some reports of these helicopters flying completely silently. And I'm not talking about, you know, just technology to camouflage the sound to a significant degree. I mean literally totally silent, and the people have come across these helicopters and been perhaps within 20 or 30 feet of them, and there's absolutely no sound. Now, which again suggests, you know, very odd components. But there are a number of other cases, several of which I've got, which came from alien abductees, who said that they saw these black helicopters, and as they were looking at them, interestingly enough, like with some of the other cases where the the black helicopter kind of shimmered as if it was in a heat haze,
mm-hmm.
and then took on the form of what we would call like a classic flying saucer, which has given rise to the idea that these things, if, you know, in one sense shapeshift, or in another sense, they have the ability to camouflage themselves. So the theory is that, you know, you could be seeing a black helicopter, but in reality, it could be something else. You know, it's almost like a supernatural kind of stealth technology to alter the form, or at least perhaps even manipulate our perceptions of how we see these things. And of course, this opens the door to even more controversial questions. Are these black helicopters that are seen in UFO incidents and cattle mutilation events, are they actually real black helicopters of a government agency, or are they some sort of projected, camouflaged image to have us believe that that's what it is, rather than have us see the phenomenon for what it really might be, which would be, you know, something far more connected to the UFO phenomenon itself.
What's your gut tell you, Nick?
Well, I think there's two things going on here, George. I think there are some legitimate cases where, you know, military agencies have sent out black helicopters to investigate, you know, paranormal phenomena, cattle mutilations, etc. But I have a huge number of reports of these sort of morphing helicopters. I've easily got 30 or 40 reports. And when you have that many reports, it's very difficult to dismiss this aspect of the phenomenon. Now, of course, a lot of researchers do dismiss it because it's too weird. But for me, you know, there isn't much that is too weird. and I think when you get that many reports from different people, you have to accept that this is a part of the phenomenon. And so I do think there is some validity to the idea that in a number of these black helicopter cases, what we're seeing is actually not a black helicopter at all, but is presenting itself in that way. Whether the whether the shape-shifting technology is a camouflage or a stealth-type technology or something more supernatural, I don't know. But the angle of these helicopters having the ability to appear in different ways, there's no doubt in my mind that that's happening in some cases.
And Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster, fits into some of these.
Yeah, it does. The phenomenon of the Loch Ness Monster didn't really begin until the early 1930s, and that was when a large new road was built near the loch, which allowed people to drive past it. That's when the sightings began. It wasn't just, you know, a new phenomenon out of the blue. Up until 1933, it was very difficult to negotiate Loch Ness because there just weren't any good roads at all in the area. And so when the roads were expanded, people started to report seeing these creatures more and more. But what's interesting is that although the traditional image that people have of the Loch Ness Monster, sort of this humpbacked, long-necked type creature that sort of superficially resembles a prehistoric plesiosaur, that isn't the only form that people have described these creatures as looking like. Now, what's interesting is if you go back into ancient Scottish folklore of the 1500s and 1600s, sort of, so we're talking 300-400 years ago, 500 years ago even, we find that there were traditions in many Scottish lakes, and loch is just a Scottish term for lake, reports of what were known as kelpies. And kelpies were shape-shifting creatures that could take on multiple forms, like a large black horse and a beautiful woman. And according to the old legends, they would stand on the edge of the lakes and try and entice wary passers-by to come towards the water's edge. And then supposedly they would, you know, seize the person and steal their soul and take it deep below the loch. You know, that's the traditional folklore. But these tales of these so-called kelpies have their modern-day equivalents with the Loch Ness Monster. You know, as I said, how the long neck, the humpback, that's the traditional image we have. But we also have reports where people have described the Loch Ness monsters as looking like giant frogs. Other people have described them as looking kind of like a salamander. You have other reports where people, one woman described the creature as having tusks. Another one said it looked like a crocodile. Now, in most of these cases, the witnesses were close enough to get a fairly accurate view and interpretation of what they were seeing. And yet we have multiple different descriptions of what most people would assume is just one kind of animal. And when you look back and tie it in with the old stories of the Kelpies, which were shapeshifters, you can make a good case that the Nessies of today and the Kelpies of the distant past are one and the same thing, and that today's monsters are the very same shapeshifters that existed all those centuries ago.
That's amazing, the kind of work. How difficult was it for you to find all these stories?
Well, I mean, it's usually sort of like a two-pronged approach, George. One would be where I do, you know, I like to do a lot of in-depth research, but I guess, you know, the more books I write, the more books I write or articles or radio shows, the more feedback I get. So, you know, I've been very lucky and fortunate in the sense that, you know, people are willing to share their stories and, you know, giving permission for them to be used. So, you know, without the witnesses who, you know, I always point out the witnesses are the most important people, because without them, we don't have anything to go on. So, you know, when you get these stories given to you, that does make the job easier in terms of being able to then launch a deeper investigation. But yeah, these stories, you know, the Loch Ness stories are fascinating in the, you know, in terms of the way in which we can make these parallels in the 21st century with what was being seen 400, 500, 600 years ago. And all that's really changed is the name. Today they're known as the Nessies. Back then they were the Kelpies. And this issue of shape-shifting monsters in Scottish lochs doesn't just revolve around Loch Ness.
All right, let's talk more about these creatures, shapeshifters, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.